Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Listen, if you've ever considered an extreme adventure, listen to Shannon Dean first. She's a Seattle nurse who had never sailed on an ocean before she decided to sail around the world. We're going to begin our show today with a trip that only feels like it's around the world, a Seattle commute. When Seattle asked voters in 2015 to pass the biggest tax levy in city history to make transportation work better, some people said at the time, this is a mistake. Too much money, not enough accountability.
If you don't manage well, you have a lot of projects that go over budget, and then you don't do the things you promised people. Just look at the seawall. It's 35% over budget. There was a streetcar that was supposed to be finished 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago, I'm sorry, and it's not finished. Just throwing money at problems does not solve transportation problems. So we're not sure what we're really getting.
That was levy opponent Eugene Wasserman saying, we're not sure what we're getting from this $930 million property tax levy known as Let's Move Seattle. And it turns out we're not getting what we were promised. The Seattle Times reports the city will scrap some promised projects and downsize others. Times reporter David Gutman is with us now. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me.
Why will the city not fulfill this levy's promises?
Well, the simple answer is that the levy promised more than it turns out the city is able to deliver. The city now says we don't have enough money from this levy to build all of the projects that were listed when the levy was passed back in 2015.
How did this happen?
A couple ways. One is that when they were billing these projects and trying to pass this levy back in 2015, they undersold the cost. They overpromised and undersold how much these things would cost. So they said a mile of bike lane would cost $860,000. It turns out it's costing far more than that.
Yes, in some cases, instead of
$800,000.
In some cases, for example, the Second Avenue bike lane, $12 million per mile. How is that gap possible?
Well, we're looking into that now. One reason why, it's $12 million, that's not just to build one bike lane. They built a bike lane and they built a top-of-the-line bike lane separated from traffic with curbs and everything. They also put in new traffic signals for bikes, but while they're doing that, they also put in new traffic signals for cars and the rest of the street, and those costs get factored into that $12 million. So it's not as if it's $12 million just for a mile of bike lane, but it certainly is significantly more than that $860,000 that was cited when they were pushing this levy.
And why does, I realize there are many projects involved, but big theme here, why does the city say they undersold the costs and promised more than they could deliver?
Well, that's a good question. One answer to that is that we have a different mayor. We have a different director of transportation for the city than we did back in 2015 when this levy was passed. So part of it is we have a new administration who's looking at the work of their predecessors and finding some fault in it, although not necessarily explicitly. The city's also pointing to uncertain federal funding with the new Trump administration, although they've been a little unclear about that. There is, the Trump administration has certainly talked about cutting funds for transit and things like that, but the budget Congress passed has as much money as ever for projects like that. So the city's been a little unclear on why they think federal funding is now uncertain for these projects.
We're talking with Seattle Times reporter David Gutman about promises of this $930 million property tax levy passed in 2015, promises some of which will not be fulfilled. David, you just said that the city is, you didn't use the word blame, but they're pointing somewhat to their predecessors, a former mayor, a former director of the city transportation department. Have you in your reporting found that that's fair, or have you found something more systemic that current city residents ought to worry about?
Well, I think it is fair to say that the list of commitments in this levy, when it was passed in 2015, the city probably overpromised on that. And, you know, we were talking about this $12 million bike lane, which, as I said, is not really just $12 million for a bike lane. There's a bunch of other stuff folded into that project. But when you kind of step back and the city had promised 50 miles of new bike lanes back in 2015 as part of this levy, you know, if we're spending $12 million, even if that's not all on the bike lane, that's on a bunch of other things too. If we're spending that much on, you know, these individual projects, we're not going to get a lot of these projects built.
The director of the Seattle Transportation Department, Scott Kubley, left when Mayor Durkan came into office. Is this why he left? She came in and found some mismanagement?
I'm not sure about that. The city described it as a mutual decision when he left. I think it's fair to say that the mayor wanted to kind of start anew with her own leadership at SDOT. And what we've got now is an interim director, Jerron Sparman, who was actually also interim director several years ago before Scott Kubley. And before that was a deputy director of SDOT for several years.
When this levy was passed, he was a deputy director. That's pretty high up. I'm looking for someone to blame here, David. Does he spare responsibility?
I actually don't think that's accurate. I don't think he was deputy director when this was passed. Kubley was the director. He was actually Jerron Sparman was not there when the levy was passed. We're continuing to report on this. I do think it's certainly fair to say that the Murray administration and by extension, Scott Kubley, who was running SDOT at the time, seemed to have promised more than they could deliver. And, you know, part of that is also, you know, as everyone knows, we've got a booming construction industry here. It's tough to hire a contractor to do these projects, and it costs more than what the city thought it would. You know, we're seeing that and also some Sound Transit projects that have ballooning costs, and they point to how tight the construction market is here.
Well, opponents of this levy point, we had a big debate about it on KOW in the Seattle Times, of course, and opponents pointed out the language of the ordinance said, quote, "The spending breakdown is illustrative only and shall not be mandatory." Why wasn't it mandatory?
That's a good question. That's how the levy was set up. I recall as Mayor Murray was selling this levy at the time, it got bigger and bigger, and it became, it's twice the size of the levy that preceded it. And what he said was that as he went around the city asking, you know, selling this and saying, what projects do you want in this levy? People kept saying more and more. And yet the way this was set up, is that there are sort of categories of projects, and then within each category there was this list of projects, which you're right, they're not mandatory. The city was saying we'll do something like this, and what they're finding now is that, well, we'll do something like this, but we're not going to be able to do all of this illustrative list. Why wasn't it mandatory at the time? I'm not sure.
Well, I've just been told that Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan has agreed to come on the air with us in about 35 minutes, and we'll talk more about this. When opponents said basically this is too big, and the city has not demonstrated how they're going to be accountable, would you say fair to say that they were correct? The opponents were correct.
I don't want to say that it was necessarily too big. I think that's a judgment for others to make. I do think it's fair to say that the city has not been accountable to that list of projects that they put forward. And I would add that, you know, the city has this story that we're discussing came from a review that the city carried out about how are we doing on all these projects that we promised, and the city found that they're coming up short. But what we don't have is any specifics. You know, how short are we on funding? what is the monetary shortfall that we're missing here? We don't have any numbers. We don't know if we're $10 million short or $50 million short.
Yeah, and how is that possible? The co-chair, you write that the co-chair of the oversight committee says, quote, "I'm not surprised by the findings, but I still don't really know the scale." Isn't that an oversight committee's job to know the scale of an overrun?
It is. And, you know, at this oversight committee meeting the other night, these committee members were asking Jerron Sparman and SDOT personnel repeatedly. It's like, well, how much money are we missing? What we don't know. And, when are we going to get that information? And to be honest, SDOT didn't really have a good answer on when they would have that information, which certainly is troubling. You know, it's one thing to say we're falling behind, but it's hard to make kind of good decisions moving forward if you don't know how far behind you are.
True enough. Okay, we're going to talk with Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan about this in about a half an hour, so stay tuned. We're talking now with Seattle Times reporter David Gutman reporting on the unfulfilled promises of this record property tax levy, this $930 million Let's Move Seattle levy passed in 2015. David, thanks for your reporting, and thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Stay tuned to KUOW's The Record. If you had the chance, would you sail around the world? That's what Seattle nurse Shannon Dean is doing, even though she had never even sailed on an ocean. Dean is sailing in something called the Clipper Round the World Yacht Race. She's 10 months into it. She sailed into Seattle last week from China on her way to Panama, and she stopped by to tell you about her adventure and what it was like to pull into her home harbor.
I remember Nikki, who's phenomenal, our skipper. We finally got to within, like, where we saw our first land, Lanto, and she just points back and she goes, "That's China," just points behind us. 4 weeks ago, many, many journeys. It felt amazing when we first see that touch of land.
Shannon, you're on this boat, 70-foot boat, with 20 strangers on the open ocean. Why, Shannon Dean? Why are you putting yourself through this?
Boy, I've asked myself that quite a bit in the last 9 months.
You've had some time.
I had some time to think about it. And all those original reasons, I went out on it. I grew up on the water. My dad's a ship carpenter. And I used to go out rowing, and I would row for hours and hours, and I would never want to come back in. And there's just no way to be offshore for a regular person. You know, I can't call Volvo Ocean Race and say, you know, "Do you need a crew member who's never sailed?" You know, so I found Clipper, stumbled on them online, and started reading about what they were doing, and I signed up the next day. I just wanted to get out on that open ocean and see it and sail across the seas. And, you know, I am not sorry I've made that choice.
I think a lot of us think about doing something adventurous, but how was there a path between hearing about this race and actually doing it?
I wanted to do it the minute I saw it, but it's not possible. How can you take a year off work? How can you leave? My kids are, 22 and 26, so they're grown-up-ish, and, help my parents a lot, and they're in their late 80s. And I just finished nursing school, so I was about to start a new career. So you can't, go tell your new job you're going to take off a year. So none of it was possible. And so I thought, well, I'll just sign up for a couple legs. So it's a couple months off. You know, I can manage that. And I signed up for the couple legs, started the training. And then I was like, well, I can't not cross the Southern Ocean because how many people get to do that? So I sort of snuck in the third leg and, looked around and no one noticed, they're like, "She'll be gone for 3 months. What's 3 months and 2 weeks or something?" Mm-hmm. And then I got that third leg in there and no one fell over dead. And I went and said, "Oh, Sydney Hobart, who gets to sail in the Sydney Hobart race?" And I went and snuck in leg four. And then by then, everyone started understanding clippers and legs. And they were like, "Wait a minute, stop adding legs." And I just added the last four. And that was it.
It's one thing to even imagine yourself sailing the ocean, much less the world. But why in a race, of all things?
Well, I was originally not at all interested in the race.
That sounds extra dangerous and,
And laborious.
Laborious.
Yes. And so the race held no appeal for me until you start racing. And then it does. It's actually very fun. It gives a purpose to your work because sailing around the world is actually quite difficult. It's a lot of labor, a lot of work. It's relentless. It's hard. You know, I've hopped up and down on that boat in tears more times than I can tell you. And
what had you crying?
Anger, pain, just a variety of things, homesickness. And I've cried just because I'm tired. You're like so tired. You know, I've never been afraid. I mean, that's one thing I can say. I've never felt afraid on the boat, but I felt, you know, we're a bunch of those 20 people on that boat are 20 very passionate people. So you can imagine the personalities.
What did you imagine it was going to be like, hour to hour, day to day?
That's different from what my experience has been. Hour to hour, I just imagined the sea and I wanted to be on the open water. And that part is, you know, I've done that pretty much. It's beautiful out there. It's everything I imagined it to be. But the day to day, we work every minute. And I just thought everyone's like, what are you going to do with your free time? And I had like, learn French on my, it's like, there's no learning French.
Oh.
And I eat my meals in like 4 minutes or less. We're on and off every 4 hours. We do 2 6-hour watches and then 3 4s, just around the clock. And you're just, my day, I'm just like crawling in and out of clothes, eating food as fast as I can, and running all over the boat, working and doing my, you know, rota, your chores.
Rota?
So we sail the boat ourselves. We have the skipper, and then we sail it, you know, so we're, you know, raising and dropping all the sails, helming, doing everything. But we also clean the bilges. We prepare all the meals. We clean the heads. We clean the boat. So we, every, you know, in our 4-hour watch, you wipe the boat down with, you know, antibacterial spray from top to bottom. I get a cup of tea and I'm all excited and sit down with my cup of tea. And half the time I don't get the first sip before I'm back to doing something.
Is that joyful?
There's, you know, there's a whole lot of hindsight. This is going to be fantastic in hindsight. When you're doing it, you're just like, wow, this is really quite hellish, you know. But at the same time, it's not. It's, you have to remind yourself. You have to stop what you're doing. Like, I actually like cleaning bilges at this point because you just, it's something that needs to be done. So you just dive into it. You know, you go down with another person, you crawl around, you're laughing, you make the best of everything. And it's quite a skill to have.
It's not like you've spent your life
on the
open water.
No.
So what's it like?
I love being offshore. A lot of people get a little apprehensive when the shore slips away. But I actually find it very peaceful when all of it drops off because it's very peaceful. It's very well defined. It's very simple. And you know, I look off the boat and I look at the waves and I look at the water and I look at the birds and, you know, we see dolphins and whales and, you know, the water changes all the time. So there's just beauty out there that you can't really quite imagine. You know, I love night watches, which a lot of people don't because it's pitch black and you're trying to sail and it's hard, but it's beautiful out there. The stars at night, and we see phosphorus all the way around. And if you see dolphins swim through the phosphorus, they light up. They just look like unicorns, you know?
Yeah, they glow. It's glowing.
They glow,
yeah.
You know, swimming through the water, glowing beside your boat. I'm not going to see that ever again.
How does that attentiveness affect you when you're on land and living that life?
I kind of do the same thing on land. Like I was walking down the street with my kids and I just bent over and picked up a marble because I saw like that tiny glint, that thing that you see when you're on, you know, you're on the boat, you see a tiny thing and you're like, oh, that's a whale. And you spot it and get to see it. And so on the land, I do it too. I have jars and jars of marbles that I find just walking down the street. And, you know, there's beauty all around us, but you have to look to see it.
Yeah, you can't pick up a marble on the ocean.
Yeah, no. Not a lot of marbles, but I'm getting slammed by this phosphorus all the time.
What about being on this 70-foot boat with 20 strangers?
Mm-hmm.
What's that like?
Well, that's for me, that's been the biggest challenge because I don't know that I'm the most socially adept person on land. And usually when I'm tired of, you know, had too many people, I just sort of, you know, separate myself a little bit. And there is no doing that on the boat. We live together. We share a bunk. I get out of my bunk and someone gets in. So I have to roll up all my stuff and put it away. And I don't have a home anymore, like not even that tiny little space.
Wow.
And so there is no break from it at all. I know these people like you've never known anyone before. I mean, we're like a big dysfunctional family.
Let's talk about the danger. Is there a rescue boat trailing you everywhere?
No. Before we left, Nikki and I sat down to make, you know, what are we going to do in these different situations that could come up? Because we're not only don't we have a rescue boat, but we're out of touch of rescue for, you know, you can't, the only way we could get help would be an aircraft carrier or something. And how long is it going to take to get to us or our fellow yachts?
What could happen?
Well, anything can happen because it's really quite, you know, you're out there. We had waves crashing over us that just would flatten you like a bug. So there's one thing to be out sailing and there's big waves, but it's another to see one tower over you and to see it crest and think, oh, it's going to break. And, you know, I've definitely been just knocked straight down to the deck. And we all have, you know, I actually feel superstitious enough to not want to tempt fate, but we did really well on this crossing and no broken bones, no, you can get cut very badly by the sheets.
What's that?
So they're the ropes that you control the sails with, and they're under so much tension. If they whip you, they can, you know, cut you. And so I'm watching them all the time since I'm, you know, medic and safety officer. I know where every single line is on that boat and where the end of it is and how it's coiled. I'm never free of watching that every second. So the whole time I'm on the boat, no matter what I'm doing, if I'm like photographing an albatross, I still know right where that spinnaker sheet is behind me and who's sitting next to it. And so
for anybody who thinks I'm going to get away from my responsibilities and sail the open waters. I would have thought that this is far less dangerous, though, than it was decades ago, just because you can be in constant contact. People know exactly where you are. But three people have died.
Yeah.
Not on your boat, but in this race series.
Yeah, well, you know, the boats that we're sailing are like tanks. So I know what we can do to them because of what we've just done to them. We sailed through this hurricane, and we saw 110 knot winds on our boat, which is remarkable. And the seas that we saw were phenomenal. Actually, that's a sea state. And, I mean, waves like you've never seen before. So you can't look at that and be, you know, you can't be guaranteed to be 100% safe out there. 11 of those boats came through that hurricane with just minor injuries. And I can't imagine doing better than that. So the fact that, you know, we can do worse and terrible things can happen and have, it was just absolutely floored me when we lost Simon.
What happened?
Well, I don't know the whole story because I haven't read any reports because I've been at sea and there's news up there. I haven't seen news since July. But he was washed over and drowned, and that can happen. So we're tethered all the time, but in his case, a clip broke. And so, you know, there's a full investigation, and I don't know the outcome of all that. You know, I think that they're doing really quite remarkably well, keeping us about as safe as you can be out in such an extreme environment.
Well, you said that your kids are grown, mm-hmm. but still— to say goodbye to your family.
Say goodbye to my kids. And I made a will before I left. I had to sit down with them and do all that because I knew what I was getting into. And that was a real fun conversation to have with your kids. And
your parents?
Yeah. So I had to, before I left, my dad's going to be 88. And he's crossed every ocean but the Southern Ocean. So he was real excited for me. But I also said goodbye in case he wasn't there when I got back. And he's in the hospital right now. So I came in and I came from there to here. And, it's very intense. You go out, you don't know what you're leaving behind. I mean, you do. You just don't know what you're coming back to.
Yeah. How are you doing with that?
It was unexpected, but that's what everything is, you know, on the boat. There's things that happen or in life. That's just life, isn't it? You just manage it. Just like, you know, the dinner you don't like on board or the hurricane. So you just prepare for it and do the best you can.
So at the end of this race, Shannon, you will have covered 40,000 nautical miles-ish?
Mm-hmm.
And then?
Everyone jokes about it. It's like, I'm looking at sprinters and I'm going to go to the desert until I dry out. So,
what's a sprinter?
It's a camper van kind of a thing that's self-contained, so it doesn't look so much like a van, so you can sleep in it wherever you pull over. And my kids laugh because they're like, we're never quite sure, like, are you going to come back and move to the boat? Because that was my original idea. I was just, you know, downsize, kids are grown, sell the house, buy a boat, move on. And I don't know that I won't do that, but maybe I'll stay on land for a few hours.
Well, welcome back on land, and good luck rest of the way around the world, back to the UK and done.
Thank you very much.
Shannon Dean is 10 months into her round-the-world sail. She made a brief stop in her home port here in Seattle over the weekend, and she is now on her way to Panama. And we are going to talk to a West African superstar when we come back on The Record. I'm Bill Radke, and you're listening to The Record.
You may find yourself living in a shotgun shack, and you may find yourself in another part of the world, and you may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile, and you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife.
Recognize that song, The Talking Heads, Once in a Lifetime? That voice is the Beninese superstar Angélique Kidjo. Time magazine called her Africa's premier diva, and she's coming to Seattle this week. Her new album is Remain in Light, a cover of the Talking Heads masterpiece from 1980, and she talked with me about it. Hear me?
Yep.
Hi, Bill Radke here.
How are you?
I'm very happy. Happy to be talking with you. Thank you for doing this.
You're welcome. I hear your voice on the radio all the time. Now it's good for me to have your voice for myself in my ears. That's cool. Perfect.
It is cool. Perfect. Will you say your name for me? I'm saying it, Angélique. I want to hear you.
Angélique Kidjo.
Yes. Angélique Kidjo.
Yes.
From Benin.
Yeah, you don't want to say my whole family name. You're going to spend the whole day doing it.
Can I hear it? Can I hear you say it? Yes. Welcome. So I'm not going to try all that.
Okay.
No.
I figured that one out.
Into the blue.
Angélique, this album that you've reinterpreted, the Talking Heads album, Remain in Light from 1980, I remember that album. There was a lot of cultural sampling in that record, from TV preachers to Fela Kuti, the Nigerian musician. I remember there was some accusations that this was cultural appropriation, and I've heard you don't really believe in that. What do you mean?
Well, the culture appropriation, when you start saying that, is that you think that you own a culture. No one owns any culture. Culture speaks for people. It's a collection of people that make the culture exist. And one thing that I always say, if you are inspired by somebody's music or by somebody's culture that's far away from yours, recognizing it is already a huge achievement. Not recognizing it is kind of an insult. But the Talking Heads people, they never, ever try to hide the fact that they have been influenced by Fela's music and the book of Chernoff. That was a musicologist that at that time that wrote a book about the trance induced by the drums in West Africa, how it worked. People think that it's always a jam. It's not a jam, it's coded. It's talking. The drum is talking to you. And music is at the center of our life in Africa, everywhere on that continent. You play music when you're joyful, when you cry, when you're born, when you're married, when you die. Music is there all the time. So if something in that culture inspire you to do what you do and you recognize it, for me, it's not cultural appropriation. It's cultural expansion.
So, Angélique, when we say you may find yourself living in a shotgun shack, so then what does that make that song about as you interpret it? You know, you may ask yourself, how did I get here? What does the song mean in your rendering of it?
Man, it means to me when I arrived in France in 1983, after going through a decade, even a little more a decade of the communist dictatorship, where your freedom is basically snapped away from you. As an artist, with other artists in Benin, we were forced to write songs to pray the ideology, and I refused. So it becomes obvious for my parents and myself that I got to leave that country. Otherwise, my life will be destroyed. I can be killed in jail. So therefore, I have to leave. So here I am arriving in Paris, September 11, 1983. And I start listening to different type of music. And I become really thirsty and junkie of music because there have been more than 10 years of music that I haven't listened to. And then when I hear Once in a Lifetime, it brings me back home. It brings me back to the celebration of African people every day and also the solidarity. Because my first year in France has been one of the worst year ever in my entire life. Because you will say good morning to your neighbors when you're walking in the stairs and they just talk to the wall and you go, hold on a minute, what is going on? I'm saying good morning, just say good morning. Greetings in Africa can last 5-10 minutes because we want to know about the whole family. Mm-hmm. And here you are saying good morning to somebody and the person is looking at you like you're a criminal. So Once in a Lifetime brought me that warmth. And also, the question that I was asking myself, was it worth it to leave my country and come? How do I get here with human beings that have no connection to one another?
Congo. Congo. Congo.
Goes on. Goes on. Goes on. Goes on. Goes on.
Grew up with, I don't know, it sounds like a contradiction. A lot of freedom of speech for you, Angelique, inside your home, but you were living under military dictatorship. How did those two influences shape you as a musician?
What it does to me and is the realization of the importance of preserving freedom. Because from one day, we were speaking freely home. The next day, my father come from a meeting with government officials, and the first thing he said when he walked home was, we can't speak freely anymore. You don't know who's spying to you. And you have to call your mom and dad comrade. And I'm like, how come I can't do that? So not only that I was mad, I was not afraid. Because my father told me, if you do your music, don't link your music to any political party. They come and they go. You gotta be free to be able to speak. Yet here I am, living with those two contradictions, as you said, and looking at my father being angry every day. And my father said to me, you gotta get out of here before this gets to you, the point where you won't be able to do your arts anymore. So when I left, it was a relief. And at the same time, it was painful for me to leave behind my parents, not being able to speak to them for 6 years, not knowing if the telephone was tapped. I mean, it's something that people don't understand. Living in exile, no one, absolutely not one person on this planet, will willingly leave his home for somewhere where you don't know what's going to happen to you. So for me as an artist, it shaped my way of writing music, my way of doing music, trying to reach out to people to create bridges for us to be a power to reckon with when our freedom anywhere in the world is threatened. We have to come up and speak up and sing it up. Because if there's no freedom, we cannot do our music anymore.
David Byrne saw himself as the documenter of his time, the war on drugs, heavy fossil fuel dependence. With this album and your work, what do you want to document?
What I want to document is that every single human being, each one of us, we have the power to transform our world. We cannot just be documenting and be witness without doing nothing. And in order to do that, I want everybody to stay in the light. Remaining light means more than just words. People are depressed right now. There's a lot of people that don't know what the future holds. You give yourself into that stress, we lose everything. And that's what my documentation of my take on remaining light is: remain in light in every way, shape, or form. Find people that have the same view with you. even that doesn't have the same view. Let's go and talk to people, even that the most repulsive, hateful people, to bring them to light. Don't leave them the darkness, because that darkness, it doesn't matter how much you share the light. If you have a spot of darkness somewhere, that darkness can take over. For me, that's where I am with this album.
Americans have been talking a lot about being divided, what divides us, what unites us, and I liked your take on this. Quote, stupidity is universal. That's why we're all brothers and sisters.
Yep.
Could you elaborate?
Well, it's one thing that my grandmother used to say, because sometimes I wonder, I'm like, why is that person so stupidly mean? Why people say things like that? Because when I was a kid, one of my nicknames was Mother Teresa. I wanted to fix everybody's problem. And my grandmother was like, you have to understand one thing and take that headache off your head. Stupidity is universal. That's why we're all brothers and sisters. No one is born smart. No one is born stupid. It depends on your experience of life, where you grow up, and what you have been taught to believe is right or wrong that create the person that you are, and how you implement that in your life. So people are stupid for a reason why, when they are surrounded by stupidity. Or sometimes we all can have our stupid moment, because it's human for us not to be perfect. But that stupidity is also acceptable. But when your stupidity turns to meanness, it's the road that you choose to take with that stupidity.
Does any of this shape how you make music, your outlook?
Oh, definitely.
How's that?
Definitely. I mean, when I started singing, I was 6 years old. Basically, my mom shoveled me on stage. I was 6 years old. And I was shaking from my head to my toe. I was like, what am I going to do? And then because of the lack of light, I couldn't see the public. And somehow it gave me some comfort to sing. And when I finished that song, I came back. I said, Mommy, it feels good. I want to be a singer. And I continued singing. Then at 9 years old, I started playing with my brothers. They have their own musical group. And my father bought all the instruments. For the first time, I saw a guitar, a bass player, a drum kit, a farfisa organ, all those kind of stuff. And for me, it was like Alice in Wonderland. I was living a life in my family that I was completely protected. And it was okay to speak up. It was okay to do music. Then teenager age kicking. And coming back from school one day, I started receiving stone and spit. People calling me prostitute because I was singing. Because when you hit poverty, you reach the age of being married to some old person. And it was not the case in my family. And my grandmother said to me that day, Angelique, there's one thing I have to tell you. You do whatever you want to do with it. In this world and in this life, you cannot love everybody, and everybody can't love you. As long as what you do empowers you, makes you happy, you're not hurting yourself or no one else, less people speak. The day they stop speaking about you badly or good, in a good way, you're dead.
Do you have a favorite proverb?
Well, I have many. I'll give you two. My grandmother always used this proverb. Every human being will fail. It is okay to fail. You can even fall below the ground. What defines you as a human being is your capacity to rise up and to project yourself in the future. And the second proverb that I love is, words are like eggs. Once you drop it and it breaks, you can't piece it back.
words are like eggs. How do you drop words in a way that you can't piece them back? What, say more about that, will you?
What is that? That mean is, it comes back to what I used to do when I was a kid. When I was younger, one of the things about me that my parents tried to help me maneuver with is that I can't help myself by saying the truth. If something is wrong, everybody will be silent, and I come in and say, "What is that?" And my father is like, "Do you have a filter?" My husband always said that to me. I'm like, "What? You're going to tell me that this is right? It's not right. Why are you sitting around and catering to it? It's wrong. I don't want to see it. I don't want to do it." And the same thing goes with my relationship. I have very little friends, because if you are my friend, if you cannot stand me telling you the truth, so I have no time for you. And when you hurt me and you don't give me the opportunity for us to talk about it, to settle and to move forward, I will never speak to you again. And my mom always used to say to me, between two colors, you have variety of colors. You can't just shut the door like that. Because this world that you're going to, the journey you're starting, you don't know where your feet's going to take your head. That's one another old proverb that my father used to say. And I'm like, what is this? Does that mean? So you got to be careful when you speak. Because in Africa, words are really important. You can say one word and make an enemy for whole life. Words hurt more than somebody slapping you. The pain of the slap gonna go away. The pain of a word will stick to your soul your whole life.
And what if that egg, those words, what if they hatch instead?
Then you can create stuff out of it, because there are words that heal. There are words that bring closure. One thing that my mom always used to say, I'm going to come back again to home. My mom always used to say, when you're getting ready to go on that stage, you have to be ready to be naked spiritually. It took me years to understand what it is. It comes to me, I was on a stage in Cambridge in Boston. As I was on the wing, ready to get on stage, it hits me that, why are you afraid of? There's no hate in my stage. I don't have a weapon. My weapon is my microphone. I call it my weapon of mass loving. So therefore, I cannot be hurt, and I cannot hurt anybody. When you are in that light, your words brings people to be powerful. You empower people with it. What you say, you forget, you know? But the people that go get those words that give them the strength to stand up, I mean, it's something you give them forever.
And that gift of words and music is waiting for you this Wednesday, May 2nd at Benaroya Hall, 7:30 p.m. Angelique, we're excited to have you in Seattle.
I love that city. I can't wait.
Thanks for tuning in to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. The city of Seattle is not delivering, will not deliver on everything it promised in the city's biggest ever property tax levy, the one known as Let's Move Seattle 2015. The city says even $930 million isn't enough to repave all the arterials, fix all the sidewalks, create all the new bus routes and protected bike lanes that it promised. The city transportation department undersold the costs of these projects. In fact, the head of a transportation department says when he told Mayor Jenny Durkan how expensive protected bike lanes actually are, quote, "I thought the mayor would have a heart attack." Mayor Jenny Durkan, welcome to KUOW.
It's so good to be here, but can I say it's really hard to follow Angelique. I could listen to her all day.
Yes, we gave you a tough act. Agreed. Let's talk about what's tough about this Move Seattle levy. The city has come and done a review and said, we're not going to create all the projects we promised. Why?
You know, it's really one of the things coming in as mayor that I had promised that I would do, and we are doing, is to go through all of the budgets for the departments and the major projects to see why are we not on track. You know, I heard from so many places that we had voted for this levy, but it didn't seem like we were delivering what was promised. So we went back to look at the numbers, and I had the new head of the Department of Transportation look at it, and indeed came back to us. Now, there's some good news. You know, we will be able to deliver a lot of what was really important to people, like in Vision Zero, we will make sure that we complete the 12 of 15 corridor safety projects that were there. We'll, in urban forest, we're doing tree planting and tree trimming. We've completed stuff on our backlogs to fix our bridges. So there's a lot that is getting done that people really counted on.
Well, is it a tax levy, a promise that everything will be done, not just a lot?
I think that when you go to the voters and the public, you have an obligation to be honest and transparent about what you can do and to have the best budget you can have. Looking at what the numbers we have now, we know, number one, costs went up more than people anticipated. Number two, we have less federal dollars than we thought we were going to have. And the third is, I think there were some very optimistic budgeting scenarios.
Yes.
I want the public to know exactly what we can deliver. So we are going to go back, not to the drawing board completely, but in these areas where we know we can't complete everything that was promised, how do we deliver the projects that matter most so we get the most out of this levy money and spending that we can?
I think a city taxpayer would like to know what is the lesson when I hear that the city itself underestimated the cost of the project that it was obligated to create. It was a different mayor and it was a different head of the Seattle Transportation Department, but you're the mayor now, Mayor Durkin, and what is the lesson you've learned?
I think there's a couple of lessons. Number one is you have to be much more rigorous about asking the right questions when you're building the levy. And also much more transparent and honest. You can't promise everyone a cookie. So you have to be able to say, this is what we think we can do for this money, and have a range of scenarios, because costs have gone up in this city, you know, enormously just in the last 3 years. But at the same time, you know, you can't make the levies about politics. They have to be about the policies and what you really can deliver to make people's lives better. You know, we're going to work to find as many cost savings and efficiencies that we can so we can deliver as much as we can. But I also feel like we have to be honest with the people. When we go in and look at these budgets and see that things aren't as rosy as people were led to believe, I want to be honest with people. I want to always be able to stand up and say, this is really what we think we can get done for this amount of money.
Mayor Durkin, rather than have a $930 million, for example, very large levy with language that says, quote, the spending breakdown is illustrative only and shall not be mandatory, would it be reasonable to have a break levies up like that into smaller projects, prove to taxpayers that you're succeeding, pay as you go?
You could do that approach, but I think that over time, having flexibility, if you look over the last 20, 30 years, having just a, you know, here's the five things we're going to do, and we're going to do only those five things, also doesn't give you the agility you need in a changing city. Because what people really want is they want their city to be working better. They want to be able to get from A to B. And sometimes you think, okay, then the money will go to project Y, but then we get federal funding for that money, and we can use the money to improve three other things in the neighborhood that will help people. So I think you want both enough flexibility but enough certainty. You've got to tell people the truth about what you can do. It's better to underpromise and overdeliver than overpromise and underdeliver.
Well, here's your next opportunity, Mayor Durkin. You want a property tax levy this year for education programs. Why would voters trust the city with another property tax levy?
I think there will be, you know, everywhere I go and throughout this city, everyone talks about how they want to make this city the most welcoming, diverse city that provides opportunity for everyone. And we know that there's a number of people who've been left behind in this economic boom, particularly our young people. This levy is our best way to attack affordability and opportunity for our young people. So I think that I will go in any neighborhood and say, for the, you know, it's about $10 more a month for everyone. That investment will make sure that every Seattle public school kid has the opportunity to go to college for 2 years.
And this time, can you promise that the voters will get everything they agree to pay for?
I can promise that we are going to deliver it and we will be transparent throughout it. And if we hit snags, you know, if costs go up, if there's some cataclysmic event or the like, we're going to tell people as we go along. We are not going to wait until the end and then not deliver what was promised. Everyone knows that situations can change, but they need to know going in, here's what we're willing to pay, and here's what we want in return. And that's what we want to deliver. We want to tell the people, if you vote for this, here's what we'll deliver, and this is how it's going to change our city for the better.
Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin commenting on the findings that the city will not fulfill all the promises made from this record-setting $930 million property tax levy passed back in 2015 when she wasn't mayor. Mayor Durkin, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
And thank you for tuning into The Record on KUOW Seattle, produced by Amina Alsadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. Tomorrow, Redmond Congresswoman Susan DelBene is calling for EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt to step down, and she joins me in the studio to explain why and answer your questions. What do you want to ask Congressmember Susan DelBene? Tweet us at KUOW or send us an email, record@kuow.org.